Well, that's good, dude, because if it does not occur to you inherently to premeditate, we're going to get along great, because I'm fucking terrible at that.
Oh, good.
Bad premeditator. Bad meditator. Just in general.
This is good.
I struggle with this. No, we can start. Let's just start it with the easiest thing that I always start with, I think, at this point. So there's a little structure to this. Context, I think, is what I usually start with, how I know people, whether it's an old friend catching up or a total stranger. You're like stranger adjacent. Okay. You know what I mean? We're very, very loose acquaintances. We've met before today, which is not true for every guest of the show.
Oh, interesting.
No, that's people that I've never met before that just show up here or on a Zoom call. And I'm like, hey, record. We're going to start right now. Yeah,
that's strangers.
That's awesome. No, it happens all the time. That's not the case with you. We did meet. We met at an alumni event for School of the Arts in downtown, like Angel City Brewery.
Yeah, it was Angel City Brewery.
Which is a really cool spot. And not a lot of people showed up because we're trying to revamp the LA alumni thing, clearly.
Clearly.
But some people showed up. You were some people. I was some people.
Yeah.
And we met there.
Yeah.
And we got to talking a little bit, and it was actually, I feel like I kind of already did your episode, but nobody heard it because my conversation with you at that event was very much like just probably how this is going to go.
Yeah.
If you recall that at all.
Yeah. No, I remember having a really good conversation with you. It was nice.
So with that being said, and having, you know, no roadmap and not knowing really where this is going to go at all, where are you from, Aaron?
I like to tell people I am from the Northeast.
Okay.
My mother is essentially from the Midwest. My father is from upstate Pennsylvania, and we moved around a lot when I was a kid.
Okay.
Mostly because my parents were trying to fulfill the American dream and like find better opportunities and basically like do whatever made sense for that path.
Right.
But I lived in Virginia Beach. I lived in several places in North Carolina. I ended up in Chapel Hill for the latter part of my pre-college education, which was an experience.
Yeah, how do you like Chapel Hill? I dated a girl from Hillsboro for many years, so I spent a lot of time in the Chapel Hill region.
Love that. Yeah. I went to elementary school in Hillsboro.
Oh, there you go.
Which was actually, I found very welcoming and kind of warm. I mean, again, it was elementary school, so who knows what it would have been like for high school.
I like the idea of an elementary school kid coming home from like third grade and mom being like, how was it? Very welcoming and warm.
Yeah.
You know, it was,
I don't know. I think back and I got in trouble for really silly stuff like chasing girls around playgrounds and stuff like that. But normal elementary school stuff. I don't know what it would have been like to go there in high school because I was in Chapel Hill by that point.
Before, I want to back up just a little bit before I lose track of it. You said before parents were moving around chasing the American dream. Is that how you put it?
Yeah.
What does that mean?
I would say I'm more aware of this now and it was not evident to me as a child.
Okay.
But we were very poor until I was about 15. And when I say that, I don't mean that we were necessarily like, you know, food insecure, because I don't remember a time where like the cupboards were bare. Although my mother tells the story where she's like, one time we were at the grocery store and we only had $2 and we had to get through the week. So we bought 5 boxes of macaroni and cheese.
Yeah.
And that's like, that like to me speaks to kind of where we were. I remember going on school field trips and never having spending money.
Right.
I remember not getting an allowance until I was probably in middle school, just stuff like that. You know, the only traveling we did until I was about 17 was to and from my father's side of the family.
Got it.
So, because I was driving.
Let me ask about that, because you said you've recently figured that out. Is that what you, how you put it? Or you said it took you a long time to kind of process it? Because I had a very similar experience where it felt like I always took it for granted that we were doing well because we didn't like live in our car or have like, we weren't on food stamps. Like basically, essentially because I knew there were people doing worse, I considered ourselves not being, not doing that bad, which I think is an appropriate attitude to have. That's gratitude in a way. But there is a point when you realize, maybe when you get around a different group of people, that you're like, oh, I actually, let me understand this spectrum a little bit more. Yeah. So is that where, that's where you're at, where you at some point your spectrum kind of widened and you're like, oh shit, I was over here.
Yeah. Well, I would say that I was clued into that spectrum when I moved to Chapel Hill.
Okay.
Because Chapel Hill is, for those who don't know, an extremely affluent, like old money UNC professors. In my opinion, it's still to this day very segregated in a way in terms of like class segregation.
Yeah.
But my experience coming to Chapel Hill is that we lived in like the county neighborhood that was for people who were like trying to get into the school system, because at the time it was the best in the state. And but it was like the cheapest houses you could live in order to go to school there. And when I saw, especially in high school, what other kids my age had access to, what their houses look like, what cars they drove, the fact that they had cars to drive to campus at lunch, things like that. That's when I was kind of clued in. Before that, I was kind of living in the space of like, I live near woods and I get to play outside and stuff like that. And then suddenly it became, oh, other people have had a very different experience and have had access to things and like had video games that were brand new.
How did you feel about that then? At that time, like when you got there and saw all that shit, how did you feel then?
I have to say, I remember feeling very ostracized by my high school peers.
Do you have any of those rich kids who like wrap their arm around you? It was like, come play video games in my house, Aaron.
Yeah, I definitely knew kids like that. I would say in general, because I was heavily into music in high school, I, you know, like in choir, I just remember being around a lot of people who like, you know, had parents that like were pushing them to go to Ivy League schools and, you know, had really nice cars and, you know, had big houses. And, you know, when we had a cast party for a musical I was in, it was like at somebody's like house that had like a lake on the back of it, which I was like, oh, this is a new experience. And to some degree, I think.
How old were you when you made that move?
I was 12.
Dude.
Yeah. That was rough too, I would say, going from elementary school where everybody's kind of still in that kind of la la land of being a kid. I was also about a year younger than everyone else in my class because I just went to school when I was 5. I know now the reason for that is because my parents needed to not have to
have
pay
another
for,
year of, yeah. yeah,
of paying for daycare. But it's like when you go to middle school, you suddenly become aware of like where people see you in the traditional, you know,
how much did that structure. Matter to you? Because that was another thing that I think is specific to different people's experience. Like I'll compare these two and you tell me where you land on this. Me and my dad, opposite experiences, probably related to like correlated indirectly to each other in that way. What I mean is, my dad grew up poor. He, by, you know, the similar standards that we're talking about, but maybe even lower, you know, he had two brothers. He never had his own, very rarely ever had his own new clothes. It was always like hand-me-down stuff. And then he started going to high school and everyone else had the brand new, cool, fashionable stuff. And it drove him fucking crazy. It drove him crazy. He like, the fact that he didn't have it. Now, granted, this is like, it was in the 70s. So he was just going to school every day feeling less than. And later he ended up with a chick who was like out of his league in a bunch of ways. And the parents were like, you can date this kid while you're in high school, but when you get out, you need to find yourself a guy who's going to be like a lawyer, that something real, you know, not this punk kid from across the tracks, very Karate Kid. So he grew up super resentful. When I was a kid, I didn't give a fuck. I didn't care what anybody thought of me class wise, or if they thought I was poor, they thought I was rich. That it never, he was like, let's go to the store and you can buy whatever you want clothes wise. Cause I had to wear like duct tape shit. And I'm like, yeah, I don't care. These shoes are fine. Because as a result of not having the need, I didn't give a shit. So that's like these full, like that's a full, another spectrum of like, do you, how much does it bother you where you land on the class spectrum?
That's no, that's a great, I like the analogy. I actually have to say I'm somewhere in between.
Okay.
So I didn't care because honestly, I could care less about clothes. Like who the fuck cares, in my opinion. And I didn't care about having a nice car. I didn't care about the big house shit. Like it really, I didn't. But I'd already experienced trauma and stuff by that point. So I think when you feel like you're on the outskirts of society, I just always had the feeling, no matter where I was, that I did not belong in this space. I always felt othered my entire life for a variety of reasons, certainly. But Chapel Hill was a very like liberal, but also very like classist based kind of experience. And I definitely never felt a part of their club.
Where do you think, what was the first time you felt that way? That you remember feeling like, I'm not like, there's something different about me.
Definitely in middle school. I think
that's where that artistry shit starts too.
No, it is, right? Yeah. When you feel othered, you're like, I got to find somewhere that
helps me understand it.
Helps me understand it.
Yeah, dude.
For sure. I mean, in middle school, I didn't even really find the arts, although I did find music. I was in this like auditioned choir in middle school, which is insane because like I had like no training or anything, but I just kind of jumped into it. But I remember moments in middle school where I suddenly realized that like my experience was that I was discovering that I had attraction to multiple genders and sexes.
Got it.
And that was in the 90s. If people don't remember this, the most homophobic decade, I think, of all time.
That we experienced.
Yeah, that we experienced. But it was very wrong to be attracted to the same sex.
Sure.
And I knew I was attracted to the opposite sex, but it was very confusing. And there was internet, but not like,
yeah,
there was no Google. Yeah. So I didn't really have a way or an outlet to discover what that was.
Right.
And so I just ended up spending a lot of time by myself instead. And there were a lot of things that I would say in that experience that I didn't go after because I was afraid to some degree to be seen. So I remember like I wanted to do cross country for like 2 weeks because I thought it was really cool. And then like that was something that was kind of for other kinds of people. And so I couldn't like join that club. I think for me, it was like for richer kids whose parents could leave work whenever they wanted and like pick them up from practice. That kind of thing. You needed to
take the bus.
I had to take the bus. Yeah. And
well, here, let me pause for a second here, dude, because I'm going to challenge it a little bit, not even from a honest perspective, but from kind of a devil's advocate. So break down the stereotype. Okay. Let's say that you said multiple or many, I can't remember the exact language you used, but let's say you're pansexual. I'm going to put a really big label on it for the sake of this conversation. You realize
I would say I'm bi, but
you would say you're bisexual. All right. Well, then let's talk about that. You're bisexual. You figured this out in middle school. So you're attracted in the 90s to girls and boys. Why not just play the girl's card and keep the boy card a secret and make your life easy? And why is that so complicated? Again, I'm playing devil's advocate to you.
No. I mean, that's what I did until I was 29, actually.
That's a very long time.
It's a very long time to pretend that you're straight.
Yeah.
Other than a very brief year in my freshman year of college where I tried to come out.
Right.
And unfortunately, the largest resistance that I experienced in that moment was from the gay community.
Interesting. Why is that? And what do you mean by resistance?
I mean that I was constantly casually and directly bullied by other gay male friends of ours about my sexuality and the fact that, I mean, they were just very committed. And this is, by the way, a very normal bisexual thing. But on both sides of the spectrum, there were a lot of girls who weren't, would not date me. The, you know, I had gay friends and they were very unapologetically angry about me saying that I was bisexual. They thought it was taking something away from them as a community.
Did they feel like the notion of bisexuality in general is like some kind of hoax, or they just felt like you're gay and you're pretending to be bisexual so that you can like play it at both ends socially or some bullshit, but we all know that you're really just fucking gay. So just be gay with us.
Yeah. I mean, that's like
it's the first one or the second one.
I mean, it's, I don't want to say it's kind of both, but yeah, I mean, like it was very much the, at some point you're just going to decide you're gay. And I was like, I really feel like at this point, like I have had multiple sexual awakenings, you know, about women. So it wasn't something that I was like, you know what? I don't, you know, I don't want to be either of these things. So I'm just going to choose bisexual. I mean, it was just not a choice for me.
I'm going to tell some tales out of school here, man. I'm going to speak out of turn a little bit because I'm not gay. I'm bisexual also. And
yeah,
but I feel like there is this, there's got to be there. We've obviously established not very recently that this is a spectrum, right? This is a complicated thing. And people who are bisexual also, this is a thing I misunderstood for a long time. This is why I struggled to call myself bisexual for a long time. I assume it meant 50-50. You got to be like equal. You got like guys and girls exactly the same amount. You have to want to date and have sex with them an equal amount. And that is the only way that you're really bisexual. Otherwise, you're... whichever one is the majority, you're that with some tendencies or some shit. And it's like, well, why can't you? Anyway, so that's a language thing.
No, but, and it is. And it's a lack of representation thing for the record, which is something that I'm very passionate about as an advocate. It's the fact that at no point did anybody discuss the fluidity of our sexualities. Right. At no point did I even know what, for me personally, I didn't hear the word bisexual until I was 18, which is very problematic when you're an adolescent and you don't know what the hell you are.
Yeah.
But there certainly was no characters in anything to like try to make me find what was going on with me.
You know what's funny? I just thought about this, dude, because we're talking about representation, we're talking about sexuality and bisexuality in particular. And film, one of the most formative, and I want to know yours too, because we're gonna get to this kind of stuff. I think is fun. One of the most formative films for me. I got like a top three for me of movies that informed my bisexuality in particular, right? One of them is Chasing Amy by Kevin Smith.
Great movie.
Which is, there's actually a great documentary that just got made about it. Mm-hmm. Chasing Amy, I think it's called. Sav Rogers made it. I can't wait to see it, but it's like in festivals and not available anywhere. But can't wait to see that. But you know what's crazy about that movie, and not the doc, but the original film, and I'm sure this is explored in the doc, so that's one of the reasons I mentioned it, because I'm sure it's like everything is going to be beating that overhead, like obviously, but I haven't seen it. But that movie deals with a guy who is straight by all accounts and falls in love with a self-proclaimed lesbian. They become friends. He professes love and then she starts dating him.
Yeah. She realizes she has feelings for him at some point.
I don't know that the word bisexual's in the movie. I don't remember.
I don't remember it being in the movie either.
But the concept is certainly not established, because the whole concept of the film is this pendulous swing between whether or not you're gay or you're not gay. Or that. And then at the end, the best friend, Jason Lee character, also same thing.
I know, you're like, oh, and he's basically bisexual also, you know, and it's very,
the
it's
only a, it's, straight guy's Ben Affleck.
I know,
everyone else is like bisexual.
It's actually without using good language, shall we say, but it actually is a great film to explore. Like they talk about the sexuality of it, like the physical sexuality of it versus like the emotional part of it. It's a,
it's the non-binary relationship of all of these things. Yeah. And how
I think in the movie, you don't really know where it is going. And I think that's also, I would say for me, part of the experience of figuring out how fluid your sexuality actually is, you know, Yeah.
So what was a film like that for you that when you were a kid, like, okay, so you're in middle school, you said, when it's really dawning on you. So was there a film or a TV show that you saw at that time that was like, oh shit.
I would say middle school is when I realized that other males like me did not experience attraction to the same sex.
Mm.
And I kept it to myself. And there was certainly, like, you know, you have your degree of experimentation, but at some point I realized that I was, like, very much attracted to, you know, multiple genders in the TV shows and the movies that I was watching. And when I got to high school, I mean, if you want to talk about sexual awakening, like, Titanic for me.
Fuck yeah.
Like, Kate Winslet became, like, a huge sex symbol for me. I was, like, so turned on by her in that movie. And then also kind of the guy who plays her fiancé, I'm sad to say, which is, like, really, I'm not going to dive into the...
Motherfucking Billy Zane.
Yeah, Billy Zane. Dude,
he's so cute.
I know. He's cute, and he's so evil in that movie.
Is that he has, like, this great kind of slick back hair in that movie. And in a lot of movies, he's bald naturally, I think. And so in a lot of movies, he's bald. And I have seen plenty of bald men that I think are very good looking in my life. Lots and lots. But there's just something about Billy Zane that once I've seen him with hair, he's one of the few bald guys that I'm like you see Jason Statham with hair and you're like, no.
No, that's weird.
No, yeah. No. Like, there's plenty of people you add hair to them and that makes it go backwards.
Yeah, it's weird.
But man, Billy Zane looks good with hair.
He looks so good.
It's just such a drag. But overall, he's a very, very good looking dude.
Yeah.
Yeah. No, Titanic is a good one. And that's what, like 97.
Right.
Yeah.
And then 96. I would say, like, I got to college. There was this movie that I rented from a video store called Threesome.
Okay.
And the cover of it is like two guys and a girl.
Sure.
It's kind of a terrible example of any bisexual relationship because everybody in it is shamed.
Or is it
a feature film? Yeah.
It's like a feature.
It's a feature. Okay. And it's like, it's basically about a gay guy who falls in love with a straight guy who falls in love with a girl who's in love with the gay guy. I mean, it's very much the full triangle.
Wow. That really happens.
I'm sorry to spoil it, but like by the end of it, like they have like a physical sexual experience together and then it destroys their friendship.
Got it.
But that was like when I heard the word bisexual and it was very like that movie was kind of dark for me in watching it.
Yeah. Well, it's the lesson is not try it out. In yeah, either the of the movies like, that we've named.
I know. Like in
both
in
of kind them of, are like, yeah. Don't bring up the threesome.
I mean, truthfully, to this day, I couldn't, and this is, again, part of, like, me deep diving into the representation part of bi as a community.
Sure.
You know, there are so few examples, and for me, there's zero examples of, like, a good, fully realized, fully explored bi relationship.
Yeah.
Where, like, you see somebody not have, like, horrendous trauma as a result of it, or, like, completely lose friends, or whatever the... You know, negative stereotypes.
I always forget the name of the test, but I think the fact that I remember that it exists.
Kinsey.
Thank you. That's the one that I'm thinking of, right?
Test.
That's the
Alfred
one.
Alfred Kinsey.
For the, if it's one, if two women are having the conversation.
Oh.
I'm talking about the feminist like test where two women have to have a conversation for X period of time without talking about a man.
Yes. Without talking about. Yeah.
And has I don't to just be test. About them.
Right.
There's a name for that, and it's somebody's name as well.
Yeah,
but
it is.
It's like the blank test to see if it's like, you know, there needs to be a similar one for this bisexual storytelling thing you're looking for. It's like, can we have one story that passes this test where it's like, it contains a bisexual protagonist,
like actual lead.
And their bisexuality is not traumatic. In nature, like fundamentally, and not damaging to the people around them.
Correct. It is not a device to get them through some sort of, you know,
esoteric. It'd be great if it's
problem.
Not even really part of the plot.
I mean, yeah. I mean,
I'm
I
okay
think,
if it, I mean, it's got to come up as a detail.
Right. I want a rom-com. Yeah. I want a rom-com with, you know, for me, a male lead that gets to date multiple genders. Right. And we see a full experience in that person dating multiple genders.
So you want to see The Notebook, but it's where James Marsden has to decide between Rachel McAdams and Ryan Gosling.
Which I would argue is a bisexual, you know.
I'm already getting excited about seeing that movie. Yeah, I'm
excited about seeing this movie. I would like to see Ryan Gosling and him make out, if nothing else.
We can get the podcast now and start writing this movie.
Yeah. We're gonna start writing the script. But yeah, and I think at the end of that particular film, I think the most important thing would be that the lead is not giving up his sexuality to be with one or the other.
Right.
Even though that's also a shame that bisexuals often carry.
Yeah.
Is that like, if we choose one gender or the other, we want to be in a monogamous relationship, we're suddenly less bisexual. You know, if I marry a woman,
right,
then I'm suddenly straight and I have to give up being a part of the queer world.
And we're going to have to resist the impulse in writing this to have the third act end in a successful threesome, just to backtrack all the trauma we've had as people watching the threesome not work out at the end of the movie.
I've never been in a threesome. Yes, right. I'm saying that in my entire life as a bisexual person, I've never been in a threesome, nor have I really ever wanted to be, because I like to put attention on the person that I'm with.
Very focused.
Yeah.
That's a,
Be committed to the person that I'm in love with.
I feel like all sorts of people feel that way, Aaron.
Yeah. This has been a tremendous side conversation. But it's
great. Right. What are we talking about? Film, man. When'd you get into film? Big film guy, I've heard.
That's a fun story. So we were talking about this earlier. This is going to be really hard for me, but I'm going to acknowledge something for myself. Yeah. So when I was about to leave Chapel Hill High School, I was encouraged because I had two incredible women who were mentors to me, who was my music teacher and my dance teacher. And they pushed me about as hard as you could push a kid that didn't think he was good enough in anything to like really go out there and audition for incredible music schools.
You said music teacher is a singing?
Yeah.
Got it.
Yeah. So as a vocalist.
Got it.
And so I auditioned and applied to, I think, 14 colleges all over the Northeast. And again, hard to acknowledge this, but I actually was accepted to every single one of them.
That's pretty cool.
Which, not a big academic person, so it must have been based on my talent, I guess. Booyah. I don't know. I can't give that to yourself.
Yeah, Why not?
Yeah. So anyway, ultimately, going back to our earlier conversation, I would say by this point, my family had become middle class. But in terms of college, I still needed scholarships, and I certainly was not going to be able to afford a school like Boston University Juilliard or Shenandoah Conservatory. Even with the scholarships, I remember getting those letters and it being like, it's still like
impossible.
Yeah, it's so much money, more money than I could fathom at that point in my life. So I went to a state school for music. And while I was at Appalachian State, I joined a film club. And that sparked a lot in me about how most of my life, the escapism of film and to a degree TV as well, allowed me to get through the day. Like, truly, there are so many films I could name that really like helped me stay myself, and I found safety in a lot of film growing up. And I also loved it. Like, I just loved the storytelling of it. I loved that it was a combination of all of the art forms in one space. And that curiosity was encouraged while I was at Appalachian State. And so that's when I discovered that I like really wanted to do film. And I didn't know what that looked like. Nobody in my family has ever been in the film industry. I didn't know anybody who was in the film industry. So I kind of took a risk. And actually what happened, and I'm going to try to make this as short as possible, is I spent 2 years at Appalachian State in music performance, then transferred to UNC Greensboro. And I spent 2 years there double majoring in film and music performance.
Okay.
And then something happened and I took a year off And then I went to School of the Arts, which, as I was also telling you earlier, I almost went to for high school for music.
Okay.
So.
You keep majoring in music, but you were doing music and dance. When you were doing music and dance at the same time, what was the ambition there? Like chorus? Like Broadway chorus?
It was like Broadway acting. Going back to the high school part of it, I would say to our kind of pulling it all together, I really wanted to throw myself into performing as a whole, as an actor, as a singer, as a dancer, and was encouraged, but I went to a high school that was very competitive in that space and experienced a lot of negativity from my peers. So both when I wasn't perfect, let's say, and also when I excelled at something, it felt like other people were always tearing me down.
Sure.
So I think I've realized as an adult, I may be like the only person, I'm sure I'm not the only person, but I think versus what a lot of people experience in like the performing arts where they find it as like a safe place to be. Mm. And they like in high school, they're like, this is where I went to like be queer and like be myself and all this stuff. My experience was I needed it and I needed to be in that space to like emotionally give myself to the world. Like I needed that space to explore the artistic side of me, but it was not a safe place, place for me. It was somewhere that was met with competition. And maybe to some degree, I got like an early lesson on like what it would be like to live in New York and like audition for Broadway all the time. But it was kind of, I'm not going to say it was cutthroat, but it was very, it was very political.
My head.
Yeah. It was very political. It was very, there were some people who sought to stab me in the back a couple times. I was still very othered in that community. And didn't really feel like I fit in, but I still loved it and I still did it and I still needed it. I would say I would use the word need. And, I got as much as I could get out of it, given my circumstances.
I think, I love to hear these stories. I hate to hear bad things happen to good people, but I love to hear these stories where first of all, you seem like someone who's very capable specifically at pivoting when things need to pivot for whatever reason that might be and not just like throwing your hands up and giving up. And that is dude, that's like a lot of people. So just not being one of those people is like a very admirable thing. But one of the things that you brought up that I think is worth maybe unpacking a little bit or at least highlighting here in this conversation. There is not a universal culture in the worlds of performance. Mm-hmm. There are many different cultures in different places that treat people different ways. And I think sometimes we paint with a really broad brush when we talk about these communities and we say things like the arts community is dot 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 or people in LA or dot 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 or New York or this or actors tend to be this way or filmmaker. And my whole life, believe me, I've spent just because I'm a very literal person trying to find out specifically what people mean and doing this podcast, man, I'll tell you, everybody's different for sure. And those broad brushes can be kind of, counterproductive when we think about it that way. And like you said, for a lot of people, that performance place is like a safe space. And it would be great if it was that for everybody. That would be wonderful because it would be a really good place for that. But we are naive in thinking that every place that has artists or performers is like welcoming everybody with warm, hippy dippy hands. Like, come on in. I don't care which letter you are. You're family. Like
It's true.
That is fucking not a lot of places. And when you add the element of performance in it, you're now talking about, and this is the same thing as a lot of other professions, but it's really the only one we can talk about in artistry. Performance in particular is one of those things where there are a lot of jobs, but there's way, 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 way more people who want the jobs than there are jobs. And that proportion is like out of fucking control, like yeah. nothing else. If you're like a poet, there's like both not that many people who want to do it and yeah. not that many fucking jobs. So they're right. both all scrounging. That's a different dynamic.
It's true.
This is different. This is like, there are some really good fucking lottery tickets out there in these jobs. And if you get one, that's fucking cool for some yeah. reasons. But there's way too many people who want those jobs. And so as a result, that trickles all the way down to fucking middle and high school with people being like, I'm going to be the fucking best because yeah. I don't have time to make for you. Everyone turns into their own reality TV version of themselves where they're like, I didn't come here to make friends. I'm here to win. And you're like, this is high school drama class.
Yeah.
But that can scale all the way up through education at all levels. And I think that it's a really tough thing to have to endure, especially when you get into it and you're like, I love the thing, but the culture sucks. I don't want to be around these people. I want to do the fucking thing because I like the thing, but the people are making me sick. So you sometimes are like, yeah. maybe the thing is not for me, when maybe that's true. Or maybe it's like, is there a world where you could do your thing with people who don't suck?
Yeah, that would have been great.
Right?
That's like all I wanted. Honestly, there were some summer camps that I went to in high school where I did have that experience, but
you must have had it at some point or you wouldn't have gained really a thirst for it at any point. If you had always just encountered pricks in the whole world of performing, you would have been like, this is not fun.
Well, because you also encounter people like, again, my dance teacher who exactly. was the first person to
your mentorship.
Yeah. Who was the first person to look me in the eye and say, like, you're good enough. Which is something I'd never experienced in my life, really. And that is important. And those people Huge. Exist in the spaces of the arts community. So I think, I don't know. Like my sexuality, it's always both and, right? You know what I mean? Like, it's a spectrum. Everybody's experience is going to be different. And yeah, I hope that more people don't have the experience that I did. And it doesn't mean that I didn't love it. You know, I loved being on stage. I loved performing. I couldn't get enough of it. Honestly, I don't think I got enough out of it in that entire part of my life. And also when it was really not fun for me, I spent a lot of time alone by myself. Mm. And that's how I coped.
What would you do when you were by yourself?
Honestly, I'm lucky enough that we lived in the Northeast and there were woods behind my house, because a lot of what I did is I just went out and hiked around in the woods and just spent a lot of time in my own head and was imaginative and, you know, was developing stories in my head, which, I mean, you know, now I do as a filmmaker. So that was my outlet.
Big
was,
hiker.
I guess so. Yeah.
May not have called it that at the time.
No, I definitely LA didn't. I was always hiking. Like, no, I'm just going to go in the woods, which I don't know. That sounds like weird or something out of a horror movie. But no, what I was doing is hiking and enjoying nature and like being in a space that was not around human beings.
Right.
Because human beings to me were dangerous, you know, for a lot of my life. So that's why that was my safe place. And honestly, if I lived in somewhere like New York, like in Manhattan, I think it would have been a lot harder to find that. Obviously.
Where do you think your resilience comes from? You clearly have a fair amount of it, the way you speak about different things that have happened to you. And yet, I mean, you don't seem like someone who's letting life like crush you into pieces.
Yeah, I think I'm like that now. There are definitely periods of life.
You must have been like that at points, at least to a degree, or you wouldn't still like be around. Do you know what I mean? Like when we go through really tough shit, I'm trying to give you some credit.
No,
when we go through really tough shit, and you don't let it absolutely destroy you, which I don't mean like literally kill you, maybe that, but also all sorts of other things. There's all sorts of dark paths in life that you could choose when in the dark. And maybe you choose them for a minute, but clearly, dude, you've already mentioned so much of your path up to this point. You keep choosing like yourself, betterment, trying to improve, growth. That's always been part of who you are. And I'm glad to hear that you think you're even farther along now than you've ever been. That's fucking great. But
yeah,
where does it come from, you think?
It's a good point. And I received the acknowledgement of it. That's something that I've been working on in my own journey. I am a survivor of many things and many forms of trauma going back to very young ages. Like you said, I've had very dark periods in my life, but I think ultimately I just felt like I had to keep going. And I think that's just inherent to who I am. Mm-hmm. And I think now, understanding that I've survived so much more than most human beings should ever have to is empowering for me, because it means that I'm supposed to be here. And to touch on, I'll say very briefly, some of the things that I have overcome, to your point. I have been sexually assaulted 3 times in my life, 3 completely different times in my life, twice when I was under the age of 18 and once when I was 28. I grew up in a basically abusive household. We have already talked about the trauma of sexuality. I was bullied for a lot of middle school and high school. I had violence, both against me and then also the girl I was in love with while I was at UNC Greensboro, which is the reason that I left ultimately, is because at some point I just couldn't emotionally handle being there anymore. But I found School of the Arts as a result of it. I'm also a survivor of 2 suicide attempts. And yeah, so I'm still here and I feel like there's a reason for that. And to your point, these things, didn't happen like all in the same year. You know, they happened at very different parts of my life, very different, maturity levels in my life, different, you know, physical locations in my life. And in every situation, even when I was in my darkest moment, even when, you know, I literally didn't want to live anymore, mm-hmm. there was a part of me that knew there was something on the other side. And so I just kept going. And now I have to say that I kind of love my life. And it's why I'm an optimist, because I feel like I got a lot of this dark shit out of my way, so that I could do something more bigger and for other people. And I include myself in that as well.
When was the last time you feel like you were in one of those places? Like, how long have you been on the recovery from the darkness? Is that a fair way to put it?
Yeah. Yeah. The last, my suicide attempts were both right before I went to School of the Arts. So I was in my early 20s. And mm-hmm. then the second one was at the end of my 20s when I was 29. And it was shortly after.
How old are you now?
I'm 42. So it's been a bit, right?
Yeah.
But I was also like, I was in a 7-year committed relationship from 29 to 35. Incidentally, the first time I ever dated a man. And the majority of that relationship was really great until it was bad. And then we broke up. But all of that to say, with time, I still like with time, you still find yourself somewhere inside of you. And for me, I think that was what I would say now. And this is something it's actually maybe something I've never said out loud before. So thank you for creating that space. There, who I am, which is uniquely me, is something that I've always known was there. And I've always had a relationship with that person. It's just that now in the last 5 years, I live as that person outwardly and unapologetically, but my whole life, it has felt most of the time in the darkness, like everyone hated that person that I wanted to be outwardly, but also that's the person I was fighting for. And that's why I'm still here. And now I am that person, like, all the time, which is great.
That is great. That is, man, I feel like that is something everybody, regardless of their trauma levels, because let's not pretend like any of us have none.
Correct.
But I think everybody, regardless of their level, can appreciate that. It's like, isn't that what we all really want to do? Like, we all just really want to be ourselves. And we want that person to be a good person. Like, that, it's both things, right? And this is what I used to, when I was in my 20s, I used to hear people say this shit all the time. It drove me fucking banana sandwich. Now it doesn't, like, bother me anymore for some reason. It just hits my ears like, oh, they're where they're at. But back then, it used to about drive me crazy. And I think it was just a big thing in our culture that was changing, because I do think that in the aughts or whatever we're supposed to call them, in the 2000s, we've really moved to, like, let's push it all the way to the level of shamelessness. Let's just all be shameless. Like, and when we grew up, it was like, oh no, there's plenty to be ashamed of. Like, there's plenty to be shameful of. And we don't care if you're broke. We don't care if you're white, but none of it. There's, no matter who you are, there's something you can be ashamed of. And we've kind of moved away from that. And I used to hear this all the time in my 20s, which was people saying, well, I got to be who I am. Well, I am who I am. Well, I'm not going to apologize for being myself. That was like an excuse people would often give to be a bad person, to do shitty things. Asshole. Yeah.
Yeah.
And so, again, it kind of got reinforced in me. Well, don't be yourself. Be better than yourself. Right. You know, do so, make an improvement. So it was like, still there was work to be done, because like you, and I think we actually talked about this before we started recording, we both kind of grew up with this idea pressed into us of, like, you're not allowed to acknowledge your own worth or accomplishment or value, because that's like a value. It's like, don't, you know, be, and that was like the essence of, like, be humble or whatever. But that really wasn't what the fuck it was. And we don't have time to unpack that whole thing. But my point being is, like, it was put into us, like, don't be yourself.
Yeah.
For whatever reason. Yeah. And I think that we all can relate to this thing of, like, I want to balance two things, right? I want to be myself unapologetically. I don't want to apologize to anyone for just being me and for just fucking existing. That's crazy, but it's hard to do. Also, I don't want to use that as an excuse to, like, not grow and improve and be kind and try to be better. Like, that's a balance, because you can't just lean on, I'm me. You know, I think fucking, like, Jersey Shore. I'm like, hey, I got to be myself. Fuck you. Like, it's like that. Yeah. So it's like, it's both true, but it is also a tough balance. And I think that what I'm hearing from you, and you tell me if this is true, is, like, you really feel like you found that balance.
Yeah. And I love everything you said, because, what I've learned is that I'm going to unapologetically be myself. And that also means taking responsibility. So there are many times in my life where I have, from a place of anger and sadness, done things that people probably hated about me.
Yeah.
And think I'm a shitty person for doing. And I just own that now, because that's just where I was at that moment. And whatever I did is not acceptable.
I relate to that.
But again, it's about personal responsibility, right? It's like, you can both take personal responsibility for yourself and also be yourself.
Right.
You know, to me, that's what being, like, the best, highest, whatever you want to call it, version of yourself is that you accept the parts of you that you don't like and the parts of you that aren't, I shudder to use the word perfect, because it's a ridiculous human construct, but
ideal.
Yeah. The ideal version of yourself, which only you know what that is. I'm just happy that I know that now, because I didn't for so much of my life. I thought I had to be what society thought was normal.
Right.
Which I have discovered more and more in my years on this earth that I will never be. Like, it is impossible for me to be that.
Yeah.
But I'm okay with that.
Yeah. I think that that is also something that is a complicated thing that people get kind of binary about. And I wish we'd be more transparent about it, especially when people are young, which is people are like, I just don't feel like I'm normal. And then other people be like, there is no normal, man. There's no, we're all different. And it's like, fuck you, because you're not acknowledging that I feel like a bunch of these people are having a similar experience and I'm not having it. That's what I want you to acknowledge. So I don't want you to then come at me with this gaslighty, like, there is no difference. We're all individual, unique, but like, no, everyone else is school. Dot, dot, dot. And maybe not everyone, but like most people I talk to, they have all this shared experience and I don't fucking have it. Clearly I'm going through something different. And that's what I want you to let me know is both okay and happening. Yeah. Tell the kids that it is happening. They're not fucking crazy. That's one of the things that drives me nuts. And it's another reason why maybe I don't have kids. There's so much that people are so arrogant about when they talk about dealing with kids. And one of them that drives me fucking crazy is how gaslighty they are with kids. They'll be telling kids like, no, school can be fun. And you're like, not for everybody.
No.
School fucking sucks, dude. I will never. For like lots of kids.
Yeah.
Period. No matter how hard you dress it up.
I'll be
the first
person to be like, I acknowledge that you don't like school. And I'm not going to tell you why, but someday your dad, you know,
yeah,
your dad and
fun.
I are going to sit down. Yeah.
Yeah. Exactly. It's not fun. That's okay. We can be honest. And I think that that is, that's one of the things that people like you, brother, that's what you bring to the table clearly, because you've done enough work on yourself and soul searching or whatever eat, pray, love phrase you want to use. Fucking you've done enough of the work to say that you know who you are. You can be honest about what you have done, what you want to do, where you're at, mistakes you've made, you know, and growth that you plan for yourself and all of that. That honesty that you manifest out of that work, I would imagine, and this is just, I'm kind of speaking as from my own experience at this point, manifests across other places in my life where that honesty, that immediacy, that awareness, that unapologetic, I'm going to cut right to the truth. That shows up in my work. Mm-hmm. It shows up in my relationships. It shows up in everything. When you start by doing that hard work on yourself, it trickles down to everything else in your life where you're at work and someone's like, well, I'm kind of feeling like, you're like, you don't want to do that, do you? You want to do this other thing. Don't you, Carol? And she's like, yeah, I want to do it. I'm like, fucking do that, Carol. Come on. Yeah, what are we doing? Like,
let me support you. Yeah.
You're like, I'm not going to do that to myself. And I'm not going to let you do it to yourself in front of me. Do you feel that experience?
Yes. I mean, I would like to think I'm better in a lot of ways. I mean, certainly I think I'm going to be a better person for my future partner to be with, you know, because I've done work on myself. I know now that, you know, my job that I'm so grateful to have at this moment in my life, I would never have gotten to, and I would never have survived like the initial process of it if I didn't already have the resilience, the self-awareness, the emotional intelligence, all of the things that I now like bring to the table, you know?
Yeah.
When I'm interacting with coworkers, when I'm looking at a story, when I'm working with people, when I'm trying to make a whole bunch of artists that you would never think would get along, make a movie together.
Right.
But that's also what's great about me as a professional, you know, and I have an incredible circle of friends, which I also acknowledge now is not an accident. It's because of who I attract. And that's a part of who I am as well. And that's why I always want to say, I think the kids are the most authentic people on earth. And I think that's wonderful. And that's something that I wish we would encourage as a society.
Yeah.
And I think as adults, we should be more authentic. To your point, like Carol should be able to say, I would rather do this, you know? It doesn't mean she's always going to get to.
Yeah.
But it's great that she's expressing herself.
But what if it's fucking right? And we, and you know what the thing is? Let me push past just a little bit. Cause like feminist issue, what I kind of just brought up, sure. You know, confidence in the workplace, sure. All that stuff. That's all true. Let me get to the even more important part. Fucking time.
Yeah.
Work, time is money. That's what the fuck it is. everybody wastes so much time with, I think, maybe, could we just, I'm talking extra words and emails. I'm talking not coming correct to your boss, telling him what you really think about his stupid idea that's definitely not going to work. You don't have to be an asshole. But this, you know, the cut to the chase attitude is something I appreciate about everybody, but it has to come packaged with humility, a readiness to be wrong, and, you know, just a general awareness that, like, you might be like, I think this, and everyone's like, ah, he hasn't read the book.
Right.
We can't do that, buddy.
Yeah. I like to think of it as curiosity versus right or wrong.
Yeah.
And I also think, to that point about time and how it literally, there's a price tag on it. I think that we generally in society waste a lot of energy caring about stuff we don't care about. Like, we put so much energy into not liking some thing that we're doing instead of just, I'm going to do the thing and move on.
Yeah.
That's been an incredibly, like, for me personally, it's an efficiency thing.
Yeah.
And that's something that I also got out of doing work on myself is, like, I don't love unloading the dishwasher, but, like, I'm going to do it because by the time it's over, I would have wasted 15, 20 minutes deciding that I hated doing it. And now right. I just do it. And then it's over and I get like 17 minutes back in my day.
Yeah.
It's that kind of stuff.
Yeah. No, you have to. And I think that's just like, I mean, part of that's just discipline, which is a really hard thing to cultivate. Our society has strayed so far away from discipline as a core value, which is like, that's just like the result of convenience becoming a thing. And
yeah, it's part of the not taking responsibility, personal responsibility thing too.
Yeah. And it's a result of all the other stuff that we want and like, of like, we want to have like air conditioning and video games and like cool shit. And when you start to drive towards that shit as a society, you're also going to create a bunch of people who are like not good at dealing with things when they suck and just leaning on what feels good because you give them lots of stuff to feel that way. But that's where discipline becomes even more important, because you have to do the things you won't fucking do because you don't see an immediate, you know, return on it. That's another thing I think that, you know, people who've done a lot of work on themselves are very aware of. It's like, it's a long-term game and it's a little by day, you know, day by day situation, get what you can done. You know, a lot of people in my life and in my family, who've gone through a recovery of addiction and other, complicated things that really give you the perspective of got to take it little by little and just moment by moment. But there's so much room for us to have more respect for each other. And this is the thing that I think I really appreciate about you. It's one of the reasons why I think I enjoyed chatting with you when we first met, was as I get older, and please tell me if you relate to this, as I get older, I'm keenly more aware of people who seem to have respect for each other. And I don't mean like some like stuffy conservative like mafia respect, or like, I don't like the way you said my name or the way you said, I'm not talking about being overly sensitive, but I mean like speaking and listening, you know, really paying attention to someone when they have something to say, just simple shit like that. Being on time, you were early.
Yeah.
People are always fucking late to this, just fine. I don't even really care. Other situations where money's involved, I get very like, fucking right. Don't be late. But this, whatever, it's very casual. But you were early. You seem like the kind of person that you have so much respect for other people at this point in your life. Maybe that's not always been true. I know I haven't always been that way. But the older I get, man, the more I'm like, I can tell right away. You're not going to jerk me around, you know, in any way that I want you to. You're not going to be late. You're not going to waste my time. And that's such a big thing.
Yeah, I strive for that now, and I appreciate it more and more. I think about how many times, as a child especially, but even in my 20s and 30s, that I wish I was just being heard.
Yeah.
Or, you know, which is also a very bisexual experience, but like being seen. But to that point, you know, well, and the point you brought up about the addiction in your family, I have a lot of alcoholism in my father's side of the family, but also I experienced a friend, and I was 14 at the time, who had a drug addiction, and it ended up, he ended up becoming very drug addicted to heroin, and he ended up also taking his own life when he was 20. But I wish I had listened to him more, you know. Yeah. I don't think that I would have saved him, because I don't, like, I know that I have the life experience now to understand that people make their own choices. Right.
Right.
But given what I've gone through, you know, including being friends with him, I think that the more we listen, the more we learn. And that's the part of, for me, again, about like the curiosity and the being with people where they are. And it's all the other things that you said.
Yeah. Dude, I really appreciate you talking to me today. This was like,
I know, we got pretty deep. We got really deep. It had nothing to do with my journey. I'm kidding. It had nothing to do with UNCSA.
Well, not really. No, but I think it has everything to do with your journey and with who you are. And if anyone listens to this episode, say they don't know who you are by the end of this at all, I'm going to be like, I feel like you had it on mute.
Yes. Although I cannot stress enough, because we haven't brought this up.
Sure.
It like was a lifelong dream for me to work for the Walt Disney Company.
Which you do now.
Which I do now.
Yeah.
And do you want to tell everybody what you do before you leave? Oh, yeah. I work for I have the most ridiculously long title, so I'll shorten it. But basically, I work on all of the live action films for Walt Disney Pictures in physical production. So we're like the execution people. But like, I have so many moments now in my life to kind of tie up what we've been talking about, where I look at like the feeling broken version of myself at, you know, 13 or whatever. And I'm like, dude, if you only knew, you're going to work for like Disney, the like thing that you watch on the TV, like all the time, that like makes you like feel okay with yourself. Like, you're going to work for them someday. And in the same breath, like, you're going to get to go to Disneyland whenever you want.
You're not taking out the fucking trash either.
Yeah, you're not taking out the trash. Like, I'm working on these, you know, the next generation of films, and also like have worked with like so many celebrities and have done cool Marvel premieres and get to go to like the Labyrinth of Jareth, which is this recreation of a scene from a movie you liked from the 80s. Like, just stuff like that, that you, I can't say enough. And I mean this from a warm place, but I'll probably start crying anyway when we're finished.
That's okay.
That like, it means so much to me that like that kid is like who I am now, because I would never in those moments have guessed that I could have come as far as I have. But it's also because of everything that has happened with me that I'm able to be here. And that's also great.
And you're fucking young.
I know.
You're young as fuck, dude.
And more importantly, young at heart. I mean, I think I probably will be for my whole life, but
no, but bro, 42, like our grandparents are very comfortably going 80s, 90s. Like, we, man, we have so much time. You're like at worst, probably only halfway through the whole thing. And you're already at this place where you're like so pleased with what you're doing. And I'm pleased with what you're doing. I'm glad that you have that job. I feel the same way about my life. And for people who aren't there yet, I really, really fucking hope that you know that, like, there's no reason why it can't go there. Like, you can still go there, whatever it is. And also, this is the other thing. Especially if you adjust your expectations of what that means, because when you were 13, you weren't like, I want to manage the live action fucking thing, whatever long ass thing your job is. You didn't fucking conceive of that. You have to have room to be surprised by what the fuck it really means. But like,
right. Curiosity.
Yeah, dude, my only, and I didn't even know this for the longest time, I have always just wanted to write funny shit, like come up with it, or write it, whatever, and then have it be on TV, and then have other people in their house watch the thing I wrote and laugh. That's the only fucking thing I ever cared about. Some people will be like, oh, that means comedy writer. You want to like write on The Office or something like that. Maybe, but it also means all these other different things that I've done. And the job I have right now, I fucking love. And I never would have ever guessed, even like 5 or 6 years ago, if you described this to me, that I would like this so much. And that it would actually end up being, holy shit, it's exactly the fucking thing that A, I trained for, and B, I always kind of wanted to do. And maybe it's not at this moment in my life being on set with like Steve Carell and being like, well, Steve, I think you should say this joke. Ah. Then we'll go over here and he says it and they're like, ah, shit. And that's like everyone's favorite line from The Office. First of all, that's like not very many people's experience in the world. Okay. No. So that's like hyper focused. Second of all, it's like, I'm fucking young. I still have so much room to maybe do whatever other version of that. And if you just stay on track with following the thing that makes you happy and you keep diligence at it, and when things are dark in your personal life or even in your work life, you pivot or you grow or you make an adjustment or you acknowledge it or you speak up, Carol. Fucking that shit is how you get to the thing that we're both talking about. Because I don't want it. Again, I have this impulse to be like, we're not bragging. We're not trying to feel good about ourselves. Like that's a fucking crime.
No, but I can't acknowledge you enough that like everything you just said is because you can have this conversation.
Sure.
And I adore that you love your life and that you're happy with it. I think that's what's important.
Yeah.
But we can have this conversation because we've both become aware of who we are and what we want to be.
Yeah. Absolutely. And it's really fucking hard. And I can't say this enough to other people who maybe are, I'm gonna say on your way up and you don't even know what the fuck that means. And neither do I, but I'm going to say on your way up
for you those won't who know until you get there.
Yeah, absolutely not. And I don't fucking know, but like for those that are on your way up, know that there are people who are where you think you want to be, who are very fucking unhappy. They're very fucking unhappy because they're not where they want to be. They're where you want to be. If you snap your fingers and got exactly what you want, there are people who are in that position right fucking now.
Yep.
And they hate it because it's not the next fucking thing. Or it's not what they thought it would be.
Right. Or they thought they were just supposed to be there.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Or whatever. It's like you got to know that
about themselves.
And don't take that as like, well, they should be more grateful. Yeah, that might be true. But know that you cannot predict that path for yourself. You never know where the fuck you're going to end up. And I really hope that anyone who's made it to the end of this episode hears that the most from us, because it sounds like we've had a lot of similar experiences.
Yeah.
And I really hope that people take that away, which is like, it is not. You do not have to. This is such a cliche thing, but this is just what's echoing in my head. You don't have to be defined by the worst day. No. You don't have to be that forever. You should be
defined by where you feel you are at the moment where you became aware.
Yeah. Or fuck a definition and just go to work.
Yeah.
Thanks for talking to me, dude.
You're awesome. This was great.
I really appreciate it. And I'm glad my dog was really cool with you this whole time.
Your dog is awesome. Also, your rabbit. For those of you who don't know, there's a really awesome rabbit here as well.
Yeah. She's fucking 12 years old.
Rabbits live a really long time. People don't realize that when they buy them.
When I got her, they said 6 to 8.
Yeah, no. Like, my friend had a rabbit till 19 years old.
She's going to be here forever.
Anyway.
All right. Cut.